Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. My name is Ben Snakoff and I'll be one of your hosts this week. With me are
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
This is going to be episode 56 for June 29th, 2010, and we've, as usual, got three stories for you. First, we're going to cover the Google and YouTube versus Viacom suit, with Google and YouTube scoring an early first-round win. Second, we're going to talk about whether or not Congress can take copyrighted works that are in the public domain and put them back under copyright. And lastly, we're going to be talking about Apple's new policy of sharing location data with certain third parties that goes along with the release of iOS 4 and the new iPhone. So first off, we've got Google and YouTube winning an early first round against Viacom. This is the much talked about $1 billion copyright infringement case that Viacom filed against Google and YouTube in 2007, I think, was the first filing. Fairly recently, they both parties filed memoranda in support of summary judgment, which is basically saying that the parties thought that certain issues weren't disputed and that the case could be resolved, or part of the case could be resolved right then and there. And the judge agreed. The judge in the case basically said, well, yes, Google and YouTube, you fall squarely under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. You've enacted all of the things that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says you have to enact to prevent yourself from being liable for the copyright infringement that goes on in your site. And the judge didn't really find any of Viacom's arguments to the contrary meritorious. So, Dominic, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on the opinion?
Yay. I'm happy that the court came down this way, just because the alternative would have been very scary to contemplate, because if YouTube wasn't under the safe harbor, then what was?
Right. David O'Brien, before we go more in depth, did you have any thoughts? Do you want to take the devil's advocate opinion about how this is going to spell the end to all copyright and all people making money from content?
I could play a little devil's advocate, but before I go there at all, I think the court reached the correct decision, but I think that the real problem is the rights holders like Viacom kind of feel like the policy behind the statute itself might be incorrect and that it should be worded differently.
Right. I think that's fair. It's kind of the same problem that we're seeing courts face with the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, where especially the Ninth Circuit, which for some reason hears a disproportionately large number of CDA cases, they keep on really begrudgingly finding immunity for certain acts from these service providers, saying, you know, our hands are tied, but we really dislike what they're doing, what this act is doing. And I think the content industry feels the same way about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. They're trying to find end runs around it because they really don't like the policy behind it, and they think that the policy is damaging their revenue streams.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. So I think that one of the underlying problems that as the rights holders see it is that even though we have this pretty clear system set up under the DMCA where you can send a notice to have content taken down and saying that it's being infringed, the content holders feel like even though that's there and that the content at YouTube will probably be taken down within a 24-hour period, you still have that initial 24-hour period where you're getting views on the infringing content. Let's assume whatever it is that they're complaining about is actually infringing, and that's eyeballs that are being drawn into, you know, YouTube and potentially clicking on ads and making money for YouTube/Google. So,
yeah, and the judge considered all of that, and basically he found that, well, YouTube is taking it down promptly, and they're not making any more money or money any differently off of the content that infringes copyright than the content that isn't infringing copyright, and both of those are important factors in determining whether or not they fall under safe harbor.
Yeah, that's a good point, and you know, I think that the Viacom folks feel like they're getting the short stick in this, and I don't know that that's even a good conclusion for them to reach, because they have all these protections under the DMCA, and Congress did this basically on their behalf. That was pretty clearly laid out in a lot of the discussions that went on before the bill was actually passed that eventually became the DMCA. And the court went at length to this and discussed all the factors in considering the act itself ad nauseum, because I think the first 8 pages of the decision were all basically the legislative history behind the act and what all the legislators had said about why it's important to create this. And not once in there did they really discuss some of the problems as Viacom are seeing the problems.
Right. One of the, I guess the main gist of the opinion, at least the way I read it, was whether or not knowledge of the infringing content was specific knowledge about specific infringing articles or general knowledge that there's a lot of infringing content. And the judge basically said, you know, based on everything, and he laid out, I think it was 15 pages of legislative history and notes that went along with this legislation that said, you know, it's specific infringing content that we're talking about, not general knowledge of infringing content. The flip side of that, though, I think is the ALS scan case, which, resetting the facts as briefly as I can, there was a Usenet group that it was basically called ALS scan illegally uploaded copyrighted photographs. I mean, it may have been that. ALS scan sends a DMCA takedown notice that says everything on this, you know, in this Usenet group that has our logo on it and is clearly infringing, take it down. And the Usenet provider challenges in court, saying under the DMCA that's not specific enough. You need to point to specific files. The court, if I remember, went the other way and sided with ALS scan, saying that what ALS scan provided you, you know, everything in this folder that, you know, is clearly infringing is good enough. So why doesn't that case analogize over to the Google case here?
Well, ALS, the ALS scan case, and actually another case that we just heard last summer, which was the Veo case, that was also a YouTube litigation case. They basically focused on the fact that, or the court interpreted the statute itself to say that a broad notice that says, you know, all of these works are infringing without particularly identifying any one work, sort of these blanket notices were inefficient to satisfy the notice requirements under the Act itself. And that is sort of the argument that Viacom was trying to produce here in this case. And they were saying, if we contact YouTube and we tell them that all of the works except on particular accounts are infringing, they should have some sort of requirement under the Act then to look out for those works and take them down immediately. And as far back as the Veo case and also the ALS scan case, which is pretty similar in terms of the underlying reasoning, the courts have just disagreed with that. And I think one thing that has helped the courts reach that conclusion is not only that it seems to be contrary just to the basic policy behind the DMCA, but also that the legislative history pretty clearly lays out that for the notice requirements, you need to point to a very specific work. And we're talking about, you know, one or two works in particular, and that those blanket notices just probably wouldn't be sufficient based on what the legislators had said.
Viacom, in contrast, counters that they're basically, I guess, if you look at their little website about their litigation, they're arguing that YouTube made a lot of money off of the files that were infringed before they even implemented the whole takedown notice mechanism, and they feel that YouTube should be liable for that.
You mean, yeah, YouTube made a lot of money between the time when when Viacom sent the takedown notice and when it was actually taken down?
No. Basically, their point is that before Viacom started sending out takedown notices, YouTube was, its entire business model was predicated, or the vast majority of its business model was built on sharing infringing content. And only when Viacom started sending in takedown notices did YouTube start taking stuff down. Viacom's point basically is that they made a lot of money before we could even start sending takedown notices down, and that's just not fair. They shouldn't have made that money. We shouldn't have to police our content necessarily, especially for each new site. I guess that seems to be what they're arguing. I'm not sure if that's entirely right, but
yeah, I think that's pretty close. And this was a very complex case because it went on for such a long span of years, but first of all, I mean, the DMCA was enacted in 1998, so we have a piece of legislation here that was more than 10 years old, or almost 10 years old, at least, at the time that the lawsuit started. So there's no question that the takedown provisions were already there for Viacom to take advantage of. And YouTube, I think, really became popular in the 2004 to 2005 time frame. I could be a little bit wrong there. But there seemed to be a gap at the point which Viacom started sending these notices, and if I've understood Dominic correctly here, he's saying, like, up until the point that Viacom sort of got off of its laurels and started to actually police its content online and see where it was being shared at these video sites, but then they started sending these notices. They're kind of saying, like, well, from 2004 to whenever it was we started sending these notices, you guys made a ton of money on this just because we didn't do anything and we didn't actually comply with the statute and send a takedown notice to get you to take it down. And that, you know, there's just a number of problems with that argument. And I think the other half of the argument that they're really saying here is that we shouldn't bear the burden of having to look out for our own content and try to police it ourselves. We should force these large companies that are distributing the videos, the giant YouTubes that make billions of dollars on serving ads around these videos, they should have the burden and they should have to take it down themselves. And clearly that's not what the Act is about. The Act is exactly the opposite. The burden goes on the rights holders.
Yeah, the moral argument that Viacom is making is they built this site knowing that they're going to share copyrighted content on this site. They knew. There's emails from the founders saying, this site is getting out of control with copyrighted content. Steal it. We have to keep in mind that we need to attract traffic. How much traffic will we get from personal videos? So the founders knew that they wanted to share copyrighted content. They knew they were going to make money off of ads. And basically, Viacom's entire point is they built the site knowing that copyright infringement would happen. They made a lot of money off of building the site knowing that copyright infringement happened. Sure, once we sent down takedown notices, they took the videos down. But in that time, they made a lot of money off of our copyrighted content. In the future, what's to stop someone from starting a company and making a lot of money off of copyrighted content? There's a lot of new companies that can start out. This was one that turned out to be incredibly popular, and we don't think it's just for them to walk away with $334 million and $301 million for the first and second founder of YouTube from the Google purchase of $1.8 billion, knowing that they basically made that money off of our copyrighted content.
You know, what's really unfortunate is it feels like that, at least you could frame the argument in this way, that the Viacom people are really upset that they didn't come up with the idea of YouTube and have some wildly successful video sharing site. And this is a paradox to me a little bit, because it seems like even though YouTube is making money off of people uploading videos that might be infringing, the Viacom folks are also benefiting from it because they're getting those millions and millions of views. Those might be people that wouldn't otherwise see the music videos or whatever content it is, like on the TV or on, you know, billboards or see it in person. So it's giving them additional exposure, and it seems like a great online venue to do it because there are so many users of YouTube.
I think what we saw in the summary judgment memorandums was that Viacom doesn't disagree with that. In fact, Viacom, you know, makes use of YouTube extensively, including posting things on it that are very clearly or were engineered to look like they were stolen. And, you know, to the extent that some legal divisions of Viacom then go on and, you know, order takedowns on these things that were in fact uploaded by Viacom itself. Now, the judge, I think, wisely kind of dodged all of that and just stuck to the textual analysis. Said, this, you know, these are the requirements that you have to reach to get safe harbor. Google reached these requirements with this side issue of statutory interpretation. But, you know, yes, it is a great forum to get your work out and to, you know, make it public and to get people to discuss it. I don't think that's in dispute.
Well, one more, or maybe a few more things to discuss before we move on, but I think they're quick. I mean, this was a district court decision, so I believe the Viacom folks have already announced that they're going to appeal this particular decision. And you know what? Like, you're absolutely right, Ben. This was a very textual opinion, I think, and it was easy for the court to reach this based on the legislative history. This was a very short opinion. It was, I think, 30 or 40 pages, where we've seen other large opinions, like I think the Veo case was closer to 100 or 120, and you know, if you go back to some of the other major copyright litigation cases in the last 5 years, you're almost always about 80 to 100 pages. So maybe there's, you know, something to be said that there are different interpretations of the Act itself, and different judges have, especially maybe a panel of appellate judges at the circuit level, might have a different opinion on the Act itself. But given that this this case was in the Southern District of New York, so it would be appealed to the Second Circuit, I think that will take quite a bit of time because those folks have quite a large docket as well.
You're right, and for their part, when Google came out and published this opinion with, you know, some commentary, Viacom came out and said, "Ah, whatever, appeals are faster than trials and less costly. Let's do this thing." I think we're going to move on to the next story now, unless Dominic has any last thoughts.
Just want to close with a quote from the Viacom website. "This case has always been about whether intentional theft of copyrighted works is permitted under existing law, and we always knew that the critical underlying issue would need to be addressed by courts at the appellate levels. Today's decision accelerates our opportunity to do so." So they're pretty, they think they're going to take it to appeal and do their best there.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, we will see what happens. So our next story concerns the, I think it's pronounced the Golan case. And basically, to paint a little bit of background, in the late 1980s, the United States signed a copyright convention called the Berne Convention. Basically, this standardized international copyright law. So if you copyrighted something in the U.S., it would enjoy similar protections in countries signed under the Berne Convention. That's a very, very nutshell summary. Later on, we signed another round of trade agreements in Uruguay. And here, what happened is, in order to comply with this trade agreement, Congress signed something called the URAA, which stands for the Uruguay Round Agreements Act. And what this did is, because of the way the copyright worked in this trade agreement, it effectively made foreign works that had previously passed into the public domain in the United States reemerge into the protection of copyright. The easiest way to illustrate this is take the works of the Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. His works had passed into the public domain in the United States. Other composers were able to freely use these works and without any fear of copyright infringement. After the URAA passed, however, these works hopped back under copyright protection, and these other composers who had been using Shostakovich's works, which were previously in the public domain, now got angry letters saying that they needed to pay copyright fees. Now, the URAA did have protection for people using these previously public domain works, but one of these people, using Mr. Golan, I presume, he filed a lawsuit and said that this is unconstitutional because this interferes with the First Amendment. The district court case said, "You're right, this does interfere with the First Amendment, and we're going to reverse. We're going to say that you can't put something out of the public domain and back into copyright. That destroys the entire concept of the public domain if stuff can leave the public domain and be copyrighted again." The appellate court, however, this past week, reversed the lower court's ruling and said that there's no problem with the First Amendment because copyright law itself is a substantial or important governmental interest. Now, this is a little odd because the whole point of the First Amendment is to protect your freedom of speech when there is a government interest in you not speaking freely, not just when there's a government interest in you speaking freely. The latter wouldn't be much of a First Amendment. So that's sort of the nutshell summary of this case and what happened here. Thoughts?
I think this is, it's a complex case, and it's definitely not one that gets, it's not a topic that gets discussed a lot, at least in the media, because this involves a lot of international copyright law, and when we get into multilateral treaties and intellectual property rights, things can get complicated pretty quick, especially because there's so many agreements out there that impact other agreements, and there's all these countries that are members to one agreement but not members to another. Anyhow, I do think that this is an interesting and an important opinion, but I don't know that I'm terribly surprised at the actual outcome, because a very similar topic was argued not too long ago, I think in 2003 or 2004, in Eldred v. Ashcroft, which was all about the copyright term extensions. I think it was the Sonny Bono Extension Act, or something close to that, and they had used this argument that within the U.S. Constitution, you have what we call the Intellectual Property Clause, and it basically states, and I'm just summarizing here, that Congress is allowed to enact laws that basically give protection to works for the, we're talking about the creative arts and the sciences, for limited times, and that was the key phrase, And when you talk about extending the term of copyright, and that's pretty analogous to taking something that is in the public domain and then pulling it back in under copyright protection, that basically we're talking about perpetual copyrights then. If Congress has the power to do that, they can continuously extend the terms for copyrights on protected works. But, you know, based on some of the reasoning in Eldred v. Ashcroft, it seemed kind of clear that an appellate court could easily reach this decision. And I don't know that I was terribly surprised about it, but there were certainly quite a few people out there who have found this to be a very contentious issue. And you kind of do have to feel a little sorry for the people that were using some of the works prior that were clearly within the public domain and then now suddenly pulled back under copyright protection.
I think there are some interesting distinguishing features between Eldred and this case, though. In Eldred, it was just a question of whether or not Congress's extending the term of copyright was within Congress's power under the Intellectual Property Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, in case anyone wants to look it up in their handy pocket constitution. But in that case, the way the Supreme Court proceeded in their analysis was just asking if the extension of the copyright term was rationally related to their power under the Intellectual Property Clause. In this case, there's a much more interesting question, this interaction between the Congress's power under the Intellectual Property Clause and limits on Congress's power under the First Amendment. And I think that's really where this case is more interesting than Eldred was. So Eldred was very interesting until the court kind of smacked it down and said, this is a boring case. It's just rational basis, which is the standard that they used. In this case, the second was it the Second Circuit? Which circuit decided this?
This is the Tenth Circuit.
Tenth Circuit. Okay. The Tenth Circuit essentially did a First Amendment analysis, saying that not only do we have to look at whether or not Congress had the authority to pass this law, we have to look at how this interacts with citizens' free speech right, because it was, this isn't a case under the Sonny Bono Act where it was just expanding the term for a copyrighted work that was already protected. This is bringing something back under the cloak of copyright protection after it was already out of it. And the court here applied what's called intermediate scrutiny, which is, at least in my reading, the correct standard to apply. It's what you do when you have some sort of content-neutral regulation. So the regulation, the law here, isn't concerned with what the speech says, only that it's, meets these certain very objective guidelines about when the work was copyrighted and in what country. So it gets this intermediate scrutiny, which is whether or not there's a substantial or an important purpose that the government has for enacting the law and whether or not it's reasonably tailored. There are a whole bunch of secondary, sort of tests that the court has enunciated for the second half of that, whether it's reasonably tailored, whether it's narrowly tailored, but not, I don't think narrow tailoring. It's sometimes used, but I don't think it's the best way to enunciate that particular rule.
Yeah. The short of it is the intermediate test is basically an intermediate level of scrutiny.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, you have rational basis where everything passes unless it's a blatantly stupid and discriminatory law. Something like
people with blue eyes can drink at this water fountain.
Right, or a law that criminalizes sodomy was struck down under rational basis because there is just no rational basis for that. There's no reason other than discrimination against homosexuals for the court to, for the state, I believe it was Texas, to enact that law. And that's Lawrence v. Texas. Intermediate can go either way. Sometimes they're affirmed, sometimes they're flipped, and it's a more exacting standard. And lastly, you have strict scrutiny, wherein the court looks at whether there's a I'm not going to remember the exact phrase, but it's a really, really, really important state interest, and the law has
compelling.
To be so narrowly compelling. Thank you, compelling state interest, and the law has to be narrowly tailored, which means that there is no way that they could have tailored this law any narrowly. There, can't be any other formulation of it. It has to get exactly to the conduct that they're looking to prevent and nothing else. And those there was a line of cases where things were being upheld under strict scrutiny, but they're totally not related to what we're talking about. They were discrimination cases and reverse discrimination usually. And those cases are even starting to go by the wayside. So if this were a strict scrutiny analysis, I don't think it would have survived. But because it's that intermediate, that kind of wiggle room between the two, this law survived.
So the government interest here was compliance with international treaties and protection of U.S. copyright interests abroad, because it's a treaty, so if these works are coming back into the copyright protection of the U.S., so too with American works that have passed into the public domain and gone, they're coming back under copyright protection in treaty-signed countries. And the court found that that was enough.
There's something here that is bigger that I actually liked how the court described some of this in the opinion. And they discussed why it was so important that we have something like this in the U.S. in order to be a full party to Berne, basically. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the way that they did it is after Berne, you had TRIPS, and then TRIPS required people to go back and actually enact this particular legislation. So that
I just tried to keep the summary short.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting little policy thing there, or, political thing perhaps going on there between countries. But anyhow, they describe why this is so important, and it's basically a if you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back kind of policy between countries. And they're saying we're going to, extend this type of, if you extend this type of protection to our authors and film producers' works, then we'll do the same for you in our country. And it basically is establishing minimal levels of protection that these people can get over works in other countries. And that's an important thing to recognize, I think. There are other aspects of both Berne and TRIPS, I think, which are important. And, you're establishing protection abroad for your citizens that are creating works in, on your soil. So that's the way that the U.S. is looking at it when they enact these types of provisions. But, at the same time, like I mentioned earlier, it is a little bit unfortunate that there are some folks out there who are using some of these works that were within the public domain that now it looks like they're going to have to go back, and there's going to be some sort of reasonable compensation that needs to be paid to the actual people who created these works. And I think what would have been better, it's hard to say, but because the circumstances vary widely, but in some circumstances, sometimes you might hope that there would be some sort of protection for those folks who had like a good faith basis for using those works. At the same time, though, we're not talking about statutory damages. We're not talking about that wide range of up to $150,000 per instance of infringement. We're just talking about reasonable compensation. So hopefully that dollar figure is much lower than it could have been if this was actually considered an infringement.
Ben, any thoughts?
I think somebody should probably check on Mike Masnick, because I'm pretty sure he had a heart attack when this case came out.
Yeah, I read that post too. There are a lot of people, though, that have very strong feelings about this, and they liken this to Congress having the power to extend perpetual monopolies to copyright holders. And if you look at a lot of the legislation, there hasn't been a ton of legislation, but if you look at what has come out in terms of legislation that revolves around the Copyright Act, it is very heavy on the sides of the content producers, the people who create these creative works. And it does not extend that much protection to the actual users or the people who are consuming those works. We haven't seen a huge strengthening of the fair use provisions of the Copyright Act. And I think that upsets a lot of people like Mike Masnick, who, for one, appreciates the those limitations on the protection that we give to these works.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. You constantly see people who are advocating, specifically, there's one guy, and I wish I could remember his name. He wrote an awful, awful, awful book about this, but his argument was essentially, I'm the grandson of somebody who wrote a very famous book, and I think that copyright term should be extended long enough so that I can get the royalties from my grandfather's work. Which, I mean, it's a bad argument, because nothing's going to prevent your that guy's children from saying, well, my great-grandfather wrote this great piece of work, and, I think that copyright should be extended, that long, too. It's for a limited term. It should be a limited term, and I think in the past, 15, 30 years was enough to convince people to that there's enough incentive in that balancing act that Congress did that people wrote really good works of literature. I don't think a shorter copyright term is going to prevent authors from writing these works, or from musicians from creating music, or filmmakers from making films. But I think getting all riled up about something that in the end was a court applying, in my view, well and accurately the standards that were given to that court, getting all worked up about that just is a waste of energy. You should be spending your time trying to correct this where it has to be corrected, which isn't in the courts. This is the type of thing that has to be corrected at Congress.
Great point, and maybe one more thing to highlight is the fact that we have this ACTA agreement going on at the same time, which will probably implicate a bunch of intellectual property issues and maybe cause additional changes like this to the Copyright Act sometime down the line. I suppose this is one point where you might argue that there needs to be more transparency when your country is in negotiations for signing on to these multilateral agreements, and you should also, it's another reason to pay close attention to what is being debated, in between countries, especially for intellectual property issues, and write your representatives. And if you have a problem with what it looks like might happen with some of those agreements.
Sounds good.
Dave, do you want to take us away with the last story?
Yes, I think I could do that. And this was the week of the iPhone. And I think you two actually went out to one of the Apple stores here around Boston and got your iPhones. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. True fact.
How do you like them?
The screen is one of the most impressive things I've ever looked at. It is incredibly crisp. It is so easy to read. It honestly puts my Kindle to shame a little bit, except the fact that the Kindle's screen is much larger, and I would still use that to read a book over the much smaller screen on the iPhone.
And the whole direct sunlight thing, but it's a beautiful machine.
Very nice. I am actually going to be interested to finally get one in my hands, not for my own personal use, but just to kind of check out. So along with the release of the new iPhone, we had an interesting story pop up in the media, and it wasn't really, I don't know if it was actually discussed on some of the bigger media networks like on TV, but certainly in the tech blogosphere, I saw a lot of blog posts on it, and that is when you're installing the new iOS 4, which is the new operating system for the iPhones, and I think those upgrades actually go back to some of the older generations of the iPhones, and you guys can correct me if that's not right, but they have changed the terms of use agreement, which you have to agree to basically before you install the software onto your iPhone. And within it, it has this interesting little clause, which has caused a lot of reason of concern for some of the bloggers out there. And it says, I'm going to read here right out of it, to provide location-based services on Apple products, Apple and our partners and licensees may collect, use, and share precise location data, including the real-time geographic location of your Apple computer or device. This location data is collected anonymously in a form that does not personally identify you and is used by Apple and our partners and licensees to provide and improve location-based products and services. For example, we may share geographic location with application providers when you opt into their location services. And a lot of people seem to think that this is a pretty invasive move by Apple because this is seems to be a change in some of their policies. And some people think this is all about sharing iAds around with people. And I guess it's not very clear at this point what they're going to do with it, but what do you guys think about the privacy implications here? And if there are any, what are the legal aspects?
Well, the most disturbing part to me is that you don't know what Apple's doing with the data. They don't say, and they leave open the door that they may collect, use, and share the information, and they don't really say what they're actually going to do. Obviously, I wouldn't be happy if Apple turned around and said, hey, we know where Dominic is at all times. Who wants to buy this information? And that door is open right now. I don't think it'd be very likely that they'll actually take that door.
No, it isn't. That door is explicitly closed. The door that is open is, hey, we know where some dude is, or some iPhone user is at all times. Let's sell you that.
Ah, yes. Anonymously, sorry. You are very correct to say that there is an anonymous shield in that sense. But they don't say how they're going to anonymize it. They don't say where they're keeping this. They don't say any of that, which is typical for Apple. But
right. And that being said, I'm the only person who lives in my particular unit in my apartment building and works at, you know, my workplace. So somebody who has the information that I'm, you know, at my workplace between 9 and 5 and at my home, you know, between, you know, at my home at nighttime could pretty easily figure out that it was me with a fairly minimal amount of investigation.
Right. So I can't help but wonder, a lot of entrepreneurs out there are all saying that the next big thing in terms of mobile devices is all about localized searching and localized ad distribution. So I wonder if there's going to be a point in time, Ben, where you're walking by Best Buy or something like that, and suddenly you get some sort of alert on your iPhone that says, hey, walk into Best Buy and upgrade, you know, your Apple product or get some new cable that costs $50 to use with your iPhone.
That sounds really annoying.
Yeah, I'd be annoyed if it were push ads. That being said, I'm a big proponent of targeted advertising because if you want to, you know, put ads in what I'm reading, I would much rather they be things that I care about. You know, I only want to see so many ads for flowers and diapers and new weight loss methods.
Twilight.
What other uses for real-time location information are there, really?
I mean, you non-ads ads, you know. If I'm in a food app telling me... the type of thing where if I'm looking for a restaurant, and programs can already do this, it can tell me what restaurants are nearby me. You know, that's me affirmatively seeking essentially advertisements. But at the same time, it's me searching for an advertisement, not me, you know, being passively served an advertisement. And now I should note that a congressman has specifically, I just read this, Ed Markey, who's a congressman from Massachusetts, have asked Apple for an explanation of the recent changes in its privacy policy. You know, some people have, you know, said, you know, congressional investigation. I think that's going a little far. My guess is it was a letter that Congressman Markey and Congressman Barton, Joe Barton, who's a Republican, have... they drafted a letter, sent it to Apple, and then, you know, CC'd some press corps. This hasn't escalated to any sort of congressional committee inviting Steve Jobs to give testimony in front of them. It's still very preliminary. I don't know how much of anything will come of this. But I also would like to note that when it comes to location-based services, every app that uses them first asks you on the iPhone whether or not you want to allow that app to access location-based services, and you can allow or disallow any application to do that. Secondly, you can always go into your iPhone settings and disable any application from doing location-based services. You can turn off location-based services entirely. You can see what applications have asked for your location in the last 24 hours. So, you know, there are a lot of relatively granular protections that Apple has layered in on top of this. I think it's Apple's, you know, recent rise and the fact that people are generally wary about this type of information that sparked this controversy.
So, just to sort of go back to one of the first things you said, Ben, what, if any, are the legal aspects that that go around with changing privacy policy or privacy policies within a terms of service agreement? I mean, are there any laws right now which require companies to actually do one thing in terms of privacy?
You know, there aren't, and there's been more and more talk of Congress enacting some sort of uniform privacy law or privacy disclosure law. You know, from our standpoint as consumers, you know, our role in this begins or ends when we click the OK or cancel, when we, you know, get shown this pop-up that has all of these terms and services in it. You know, that's as far as our role goes. We can choose to do the upgrade and agree to these new terms, or we can not agree to the new terms and not do the upgrade, or, you know, be forced to return our brand new shiny iPhone when we didn't agree to those terms. That's really as far as we can go, at least, you know, to the best of my knowledge.
So that's a great point you made about, you know, you basically opt into allowing companies to do this if they have this language in their terms of service agreements as soon as you buy the phone. But, you know, you have to wonder with, and there has been a lot of concern over just privacy in general these days. If you think about all that's gone on with Facebook lately, also stuff that's gone on with Twitter, and I think even recently we saw the FTC tell Twitter how to, you know, take care of security better even. There's obviously a public concern about privacy, and you have to wonder if all companies then start including clauses like this in their terms of service agreements, which basically allow them to do whatever they want with your real-time geographic location information on your mobile devices, which you probably carry with you all the time. It almost becomes like it's so ubiquitous at that point. There's nothing you can do to get around it, and it seems that if you can't avoid it, then that might be a problem by itself, because it's companies sort of taking control of the reins and doing what they want to do with your data without leaving you much choice for more private options.
To do some shameless self-promotion, David, when you and I were on Twill a few months ago now, I remember, I forget what the context was, but something like this came up, and I had suggested some sort of congressional remedy to this, and I think it was Ernie Svensson had suggested a free market alternative where, in the end, we get to decide which service we want to go with based on whether or not we like their terms of services and terms of service. And I think you hit the nail on the head that these terms of service are likely to become industry standard, at which point in time it'll have to be Congress who steps in to say, this is what you can and can't do, this is how you must disclose or can't disclose this kind of information. Because, you know, if this is a standard, if that term becomes standard in every contract that you click through, then there's no free market force there. I can't choose a competitor who doesn't have that, because there are no competitors who don't have that term.
Right, and that's something that's, you know, you find in a lot of industries where there are a very few number of players who are actually producing the hardware platforms and the software that goes along with it, so that the oligopoly basically then has control of what industry standards there are. And this is a high cost industry. It's very expensive to create a company that, you know, does wireless devices and get in with all the right people. I don't think there have been a lot of startups in the last several years that have tried to do this and successfully became one of the major players in this field. Dominic, do you have any thoughts on any of the stuff that we've been talking about?
I'd like a little more transparency in terms of what Apple is actually doing. I'm personally not too worried about it, just because I don't think that they can politically get away with anything particularly egregious, because the public outcry would be pretty big. We're not quite, privacy isn't dead yet, no matter how much certain social network CEOs may want it to be. So,
interesting side note, if I can divert for just 1 second. I believe it was Jason Calacanis who very publicly deleted his Facebook profile. He apparently failed to turn off automatic updates from services like YouTube and Twitter to Facebook, and as a result, when he went in and modified one of those accounts, he immediately reactivated his Facebook profile and got so angry that they got someone from Facebook to go in and physically permanently delete his account so that it wouldn't be reactivated.
Wow. Yeah, Jason has been quite outspoken, I think, in the last couple of months against a lot of the Facebook policies in terms of privacy and how they've been burning users, at least in his view. So it's actually kind of interesting, though, that happened to him like that.
Yeah, Facebook is Hotel California. You can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Really interesting stuff here, and I think we've hit the main points, and that's, of course, that there isn't a whole lot of law that controls this stuff right now. There are some best practices things that the FTC has in some of the regulations, but mostly those involve websites that have to deal with children under the age of 13. Who knows, though, in the near future, we might see some positive changes in the law which require more than just disclosure of, you know, privacy practices with regard to personal information, and actually require companies to follow certain things. Who knows?
And on that note, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm going to jump in one more time. I posted a link in the show notes that you guys will be able to check out. It's a story on NPR that discusses lobbying efforts on the part of various small internet companies to combat new legislation that's been introduced in Congress about how people have to disclose how they use certain user information. So check that out. It's a pretty short story, and it's very interesting.
Well, very good. Any final thoughts, Dominic?
All set.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to the Technically Legal Podcast. My name is David O'Brien, and with me this week were...
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
As always, you can send us comments at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Visit the website, technicallylegal.org, to read our blog, or check us out on Twitter at @tetlegal. And we'll see you next week. Take care. Until next week, have a wonderful week. And let me redo that ending.